The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Lee Alexander. So glad you could come along with us this week on Tech Weekly. Coming up,
just recently, someone who was part of the trolling era of Anonymous tweeted at me and said, Anonymous was never supposed to become political. It was never supposed to be activism. We were hellraisers, you know? How did this happen? And I still think Anonymous is a great example of a historical aberration.
Anthropologist and author Gabriella Coleman joins us to discuss her latest book, Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, an in-depth and comprehensive look at the hacktivist and prankster culture of Anonymous. We'll also be talking about Barack Obama's support for net neutrality, why Google leased a NASA airbase for a cool $1.16 billion, and the online backlash against comedian Dapper Laughs, a YouTube and Vine celebrity whose TV show is turning his fame into infamy. We'll have all the latest discussions for you on the show. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio this week, I'm joined by our head of technology here at The Guardian, Jemima Gish.
Hi.
Welcome. We also have Samuel Gibbs with us, Guardian tech reporter, and I hear the only man in the building wearing a baby blue Google Glass. Is this true, Sam?
That's true. Yep. Guilty as charged.
And finally, we have Alex Hearn, Guardian tech reporter, Dogecoin guru, and unofficial Taylor Swift correspondent.
Officially the unofficial Taylor Swift correspondent.
What do you think of the new video, Alex?
Oh, it's gorgeous, isn't it?
Absolutely. Okay. Let's kick off this week with news of the U.S. president's strong stance on net neutrality. Alex, he's just delivered electoral chaos for the Democrats while he's embroiled in a rearguard low-level war in Iraq. Why has a beleaguered President Obama now decided to weigh in on net neutrality?
I mean, the why is really the interesting part. It's one of those issues which, for a certain small constituency, has been a talking point for years, literally years. In 2008, it was part of Barack Obama's electoral platform. He said, you know, we're going to make a stance on this. Backing up net neutrality itself is essentially the concept that all packets of data on the internet should be treated equally, that information that comes from Google should come to your home computer along the same lines, at the same speed, with the same priority, as information that comes from a tiny startup with just enough money to pay for its own web hosting.
And telecoms corporations are seeking privileged treatment, aren't they?
Right. So this thing, in America especially, where the ISP market has barely any competition. There's a few major companies that deal with this last mile of telephone cable that deliver internet to almost the whole country. Because they have such market power, they are seeking to use that to essentially get paid at both ends. They want not only you to pay for your internet access, but also for the company whose data they're serving you to pay them either to go faster, to hear their way, to pay for extra better access, or if you're listening to the people who are pushing net neutrality, they'll pay to really be delivered at all. If you don't pay, you get put in an internet slow lane.
For example, my Netflix might work poorly on one provider, and if I want good Netflix, I have to pay a different provider.
Right. Netflix has really become part of the reason why it's bubbled back up. In 2008, this was a largely theoretical issue. It was being mooted, but at the same time, broadband capacity was expanding wildly, and it really was a time when we had more bandwidth than we knew what to do with.
Net neutrality is perceived to be important to Barack Obama, but when he had the chance to appoint a new head of the FCC, what did he do?
He appointed someone straight out of the cable industry. Tom Wheeler had formerly worked for many years for the trade body of the cable industry and then moved sideways into government, where he now heads up the Federal Communications Commission. He's the man in charge of implementing all of these things that Barack Obama asks for, and yet he seems to be someone who is, at least on principle, opposed to them. He comes from the industry which is fighting them tooth and nail, and he has been on both sides of the issue since he joined government. In March 2014, he was on one side. April, he switched back. July, he switched back again. And now, the man who is essentially his boss is telling him to switch a fourth time.
It's worth pointing out that part of the reason the FCC had so many submissions into its public consultation about net neutrality was because of a talk show host in the States. who had something like 3.7 million responses in for a public consultation, which has to be unprecedented.
Yeah, it was John Oliver.
John Oliver, that's it, thank you, on HBO.
Yeah, he explicitly called on his viewers to send in consultations, put the URL at the bottom of the screen, and basically called to the keyboard warriors of the internet, use your powers for good.
So, Jemima, what is this proposed reclassification and how would it affect the companies?
Well, at the moment, the internet is classified as an information service, which means it has much looser regulation and less government oversight, effectively. But if they reclassified it, it would have the same classification as a phone service. So much, much more regulation, and the government could have much more of a say in how it's run. But that's very contentious, perhaps not surprisingly. The Republicans have tried to label this as the Obamacare moment for the internet, which is a sort of gross characterization of the situation here, because what it's about is similar, but it's about big business wanting to retain control of revenue streams, basically.
Sam, do you have any thoughts on the internet as a utility?
It's one of those interesting things. We're constantly gobbling bandwidth. I mean, for instance, the Netflix thing. We're heading towards 4K video, and Netflix is one of the only places where you can get 4K video. But 4K video requires 25 megabits a second. So we're looking at a huge amount of data. If you get stuck in the slow lane for that, it's just not going to happen. And when it comes to delivering video, Netflix isn't the only one. I mean, there are lots of video services, and to maintain competition in the services arena, net neutrality is almost essential, because the small guys will not be able to play with the big guys, and then you won't be able to get the development of these big companies. Like, can you imagine if, say, back in the realms of when Google started, we had this issue? Google would not be where it is today if the net neutrality rules were knackered, because people like Excite and Yahoo would be owning the space, and they would not be able to afford to pay for the bandwidth to get where they are now.
It's favourable on incumbents. I think that's, and it doesn't allow the internet to be the kind of democratic platform to which it aspires.
It is worth noting, though, that all of this debate is about the so-called last mile, the distance between essentially where the big corporate enterprise infrastructure ends and it becomes a single cable going to your home or your workplace. Beyond that, back when you get onto the backbone of the internet, net neutrality kind of hasn't applied for quite a long time, and none of what Obama said will deal with it then. This is a strictly consumer end user debate. In terms of what's called peering, which is essentially the way all of the people providing the backbone of the internet share their bandwidth, everything's out the window there. And that is where the infrastructure arguments apply. If Netflix is going to start pumping up 4K internet, that changes the nature of the backbone of the internet quite considerably. And there is a genuine fear that Netflix could just make it all fall over.
I mean, one thing I'll say on the video streaming side is that we've gone to content delivery networks. So it used to be when we first started that everything was coming from one server across the entire internet. Now the content delivery networks are much closer to your home. So when you require a show from the BBC iPlayer, if your stream is poor, it generally means that the content delivery network you're trying to connect to is far away from you. If it's close to you, you get a good stream instantly. And that's one of the reasons we get buffering in the UK, and it's the same in the US.
An important ongoing issue for the future of online. Keep up with this story at theguardian.com/technology. Search giant Google has signed a 60-year, $1.16 billion lease to renovate three large hangars in a NASA airfield outside of San Francisco. One of these is the historic Hangar 1, a landmark that's so big that weather can form inside. Sam, what is Google going to do with its own space base?
Well, it's basically bought the airfield next door to it. So when we're looking at this, it is literally next door to the Googleplex on the San Francisco Bay. And it's been using the Moffett Field Naval Air Station, as it's properly called, as it's basically its car park for its private jets. But what it's gone into a deal, basically a 60-year lease with NASA to take the whole of the airfield off its hands, with a pledge of $200 million US dollars to basically renovate the landmarks. So the hangar one you mentioned, it was originally built to build the US's airships. So if you imagine the enormous airships. So this thing is 60 meters high and it's 8 acres. It covers 8 acres. It's one of the biggest in the world freestanding structures.
It must cost a lot to maintain.
Indeed, yes. And it needs quite a lot of renovation. So that's one of the parts of the deal. And there's hangar 2 and 3. They're not quite as big, but they're very similar. And effectively, what Google's pledged to do is renovate, turn it into a historical kind of landmark with an education center and a bit of museum to tell about the interaction between the aviation industry, the space industry, and Silicon Valley. So that's their angle for here. But really, I think the hangars themselves, they have use as development sites. So Google has its eye on things way beyond consumer electronics and internet services. It's a platform for its Google X Labs, which are basically its moonshot division, which previously has developed Google Glass, and it's recently big on the health data. So it's
their high-end future tech.
Yes, it's basically anything and everything that they might see might be profitable in the future, but also might be for the good of the world, maybe.
What we want to know is this: is this Sergey Brin's pet project where he's going to build a spaceship because frankly he can afford it and launch it in a couple of years?
Well, put it this way, Google hasn't said, but it has licensed the area for space exploration research, aviation research, and robotics and rover research.
Like
so
moon rover
research.
Wow.
So
Mars rover?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of Google's aims.
Google.Mars.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, they've got a 20 million prize for any private company that can manage to get a robot onto the moon that will be able to drive 500 meters and send pictures back to Earth before 2015. Now they're not doing anything in and of themselves, but there's no reason they couldn't. Switch up gears and do it. Do an Elon Musk, and the next SpaceX could be Google X.
So a drone mission.
A drone mission for sure. I mean, it's one of those interesting things where I think Google's doing this both for their own space. So they've already taken up a chunk of this land with their own expansion, because as they've added more engineers, they need more space. I think it's kind of like nostalgia factor for the massive building, because it's huge, and it's quite beautiful from the outside as a piece of architecture.
It's very beautiful. It was built in the 30s, and it's an architectural classic in its own right. If you go into the reception at the main Google building in Mountain View, there's one of the Virgin Galactic spacecraft hanging in the hallway. You know, this is not just a hobby of Sergey Brin's. This is one of his real passions. He grew up in the Soviet Union, and there was intense interest in the space industry in the 80s. It was enormously glamorous. And I don't think it's just a pipe dream. I think it's actually a real ambition. I think he really wants to send something up there.
I mean, if you look at its recent purchases, things like Boston Dynamics and a whole host of other robotics companies, there's no reason they couldn't. All they need is a rocket behind the thing and away it goes.
Alex, have you got something to add?
Yeah, it's worth mentioning, you know, bringing up SpaceX and Google X, and Google has enough cash to buy SpaceX outright 10 times over. I mean, Elon Musk doesn't need to sell. This is the bigger hold up right now. Musk has enough money to keep SpaceX as his plaything. But if one day SpaceX goes public, or if one day Google comes to an agreement, they could buy the whole thing outright and have their own little space playground.
I don't know whether I should be scared or that's actually sounds quite cool.
As long as he sells tickets to the space playground.
Yes, for an exorbitant amount, there will be tickets to the Google Space Playground.
For more on this and other stories, theguardian.com/technology. So ITV has distanced itself from comedian Daniel O'Reilly, better known as Dapper Laughs. The network has declined to renew his lad humor show called Dapper Laughs on the Pull after some footage of him making rape jokes during a gig went viral. It drew an online petition with over 60,000 signatures. So what do we have to learn from an episode like this? How quickly information and social censure travels? Are we looking at a new climate for comedy?
I just think he's a dick. What I actually think is that this is the same kind of mentality as page three. That somehow if somebody can say, oh, well, it's all right, it's just a bit of banter, then that makes it okay. And therefore that excuses whatever sort of ridiculous, sexist, racist, whatever kind of filth is about to sort of spew forth, and gives people an excuse, a kind of safe area in which to say whatever they fucking like.
And we now have the tools and the infrastructure for pushback against this in a way that we didn't in the history of lad humour in page three or whatever.
Well, and also they have the tools of abuse in a way that they never have. And he has an audience online through YouTube in a very intimate, free, global capacity. And he can reach and he can influence people. And, you know, if you're younger and a bit more impressionable and you see someone who is being given validity by being on television as well as this, then you think, you know, that viewpoint is then okay. And it's absolutely not okay. This is casual sexism, and it's really not only in very bad taste, but really offensive.
Something I find quite interesting is how the whole thing played out, which is, I mean, to a large extent, the campaign against him was came from the Mirror newspaper. But it didn't actually start as a campaign against that. It started with actually quite gently sort of poking fun at him. A blog post that was them going through his Christmas album, track by track, and taking the piss out of it. I mean, you know, they weren't friendly. But at the same time, they were not by any means laying into him 100% as a misogynist who should not be on television. What happened then was he sicked his fans on them.
He accused them of actually depriving homeless charities of the money that they would have made from this album.
Right, because the album, some of the money from the album was going to go to Shelter, and so, you know, he turned this criticism of him into an attack on Shelter. The Mirror then started a second campaign to donate money that you would have given to Shelter by listening directly to Shelter and not listening.
So Shelter actually said it wouldn't take the funds.
They did, but then also somebody worked out the numbers and worked out that the revenue from Spotify is so low and that he's likely to sell so few albums that you're talking like 40 quid. Yeah. In which case, I will personally pay Shelter 40 quid to just have nothing to do with this really vile person.
But I do think it was Shelter saying that they weren't going to take the money that really kicked off the campaign as something against Dapolos in general, rather than a little squabble between a blog and a comedian. It began as, you know, his album's bad, are you depriving charity of money? The charity steps in and goes, we don't want anything to do with you if this is the way you react to criticism and if this is the way you treat women. And then that was a sign that actually, you know what, maybe this guy's more unacceptable than just making a bad album. Review his actions, review the way he treats women, both before and after.
Because he said some really upsetting things that I don't even want to like repeat on the show to a woman who was attending his gig.
Right. I mean, what he is in his show is he is the apotheosis of lad culture. It's the same sort of things which have been attacked over and over again on sites like Unilad or the Lad Bible. And it's just that through, I mean, actually there is a sort of triumph of social media story through Vine, especially. He managed to go direct to the audience of those sites, but with something that TV commissioners could look at and go, oh, we can make a show out of that. And that's the difference. If you're an ITV2 commissioner, you can't really look at a site like The Lad Bible and go, oh, here, you know, here's a ready-made TV show. You can look at a character like Dapper Laughs.
Who's on Vine, yeah.
His last ITV show, I think I read it had 119,000 viewers.
I mean, this thing.
We scoff at these figures on the internet.
I mean, yeah, actually, he didn't have anywhere near as viewers as many viewers as he would have had for a typical Vine post.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, is the audience for this person going to be online rather than in person? I think it's just interesting to see the way that the viral culture that can make a celebrity out of someone can also remove that celebrity from them or create real world consequences for their more formal acquaintances.
I think that's true. I also think that there's something to be said about whether or not the culture that's intrinsic to Vine is amenable to transplant to television. If you're a TV commissioner, obviously looking at all of these hot Vine stars, it's really appealing to go, I want to try and take you and transplant you onto television. But the wonder of Vine is that the best people on it are astonishingly good at telling full stories in 6 seconds.
And way better than him. And actually, I think ITV, you know, deserves a bit of scrutiny for looking at the vines of this guy who clearly has a certain attitude that I would say sort of belongs in the 70s, who has an attitude and thought, oh yeah, what a great idea to give him a platform on national TV.
the format is so challenging and exciting, and they have that just little 2 second sting of a song at the end of a video that just makes it, and that wouldn't even translate to television in the first place.
I think we should ask our readers and listeners to suggest their favourite Vine characters, and we'll send them to ITV2's commissioner.
But what I would also genuinely be curious to see, and I'm really annoyed ITV2 deprived us of this, is whether someone who, you know, actually isn't a terrible person, but who is good at Vine, can make a good TV show, because I'm not sure that the skills are the same. I'm a writer, but if you sat me down and told me to write a novel, I'd look at you like you're insane. Those are two different mediums, and I can't write a novel. And I wonder whether, you know, Vine is comedy, sure, but a 6 second Vine and a 30 minute TV show are very different skills, and what makes you good at one doesn't necessarily translate.
And also, I think we've moved past the point now where you haven't really succeeded until you've been on TV, because who watches TV anymore? I watch Channel 4 News, that's about it. There's a very occasional, I turn it on, I flick through, there's nothing on, I put something on demand. That's, well, maybe that is television, I don't know.
Yeah. But
it's on in the background anyway. I don't sit down and watch it anymore.
So there are definitely interesting implications here for media formats, but there's also, I think, a bigger conversation that we can be having about our values in public spaces. There was a similar article this week in the Daily Dot by Lindy West. It was about a veteran American comedian, Artie Lang, who recently apologized for what I pretty sure it was a racist joke, and he apologized and he said, oh, well, it's a different world. And it is, thanks to social media. Groups have many more outlets to do this pushback against what they see as discriminatory and exclusive, you know, dominant values that have dominated entertainment for so long. And yeah. I think we're going to see a lot more viral censure and viral apology going on in the entertainment space.
Viral censure is actually a really interesting phrase, and it's something that, you know, I can see. There will be people who will cite that as a bad thing, you know, because censorship is bad. But
I meant censure.
Right, but this thing, same linguistic root,
okay,
and easy to conflate the two.
Okay,
but,
professor.
But no, you're right. Like, this thing, there is on many people's part, there is an instinctive kickback against ever being told you can't say that. And that is, you know, what's happening is that the voices who are saying you can't say that are now harder than ever to dismiss. I think it's twofold. It's, they can be heard now thanks to social media, but also you can't just do what you might have done 10, 15 years ago and go, oh, you're putting words in people's mouths.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot easier to see that actually, no, there are a huge amount of people.
Yeah, and on one hand, we do have the opportunity to evolve our social norms in public and change the way that we think and talk about things. On the other hand, it is, in a large way, a bit worrying that for speaking slightly out of turn, all of Twitter can come down on you. So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops. Many thanks to our esteemed tech team, Jemima Kish, Alex Hearn, Sam Gibbs, for all of these stories and so much more. Find us at theguardian.com/technology.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
To put the citizens before your own comforts and desires, to promote the unity of our species rather than the division of our planet. These are your brothers and sisters. Do not condemn them, and never forget them. We are anonymous, we are legion. We can forgive, though we shall never forget. Expect us.
You've no doubt heard a thing or two about Anonymous, the famous underground collective of online tricksters and hacktivists. But who these people are, how they work, and what motivates them is an incredibly complex and fascinating topic that's not so easy to pin down. In her new book, Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, anthropologist and author Dr. Gabriella Coleman, McGill University's Wolf Chair in Scientific and Technological Literacy, shares learnings from intensive research over years spent very close to Anonymous, and is quite thought-provoking and surprising work. Happy to say that in the studio today, calling in from McGill University, we have Biella Coleman to talk about her new book. So you began researching Anonymous in about 2007 or 2008?
Yes, it was in 2008 when I turned my attention to them.
And what sparked your interest in the group?
So at the time, I had a secret project on the Church of Scientology. As someone who studies geeks and hackers, there was a very, very interesting set of battles that had taken place in the 1990s and 2000s, where geeks and hackers were very, very critical of the Church of Scientology. And the Church of Scientology had gone after its critics, and especially those who had circulated secret church documents. So then in 2008, there was something by the name of Anonymous that started to kind of prank the Church of Scientology, troll them, and then eventually protest them. So since I had this project already ongoing on the Church of Scientology, it was a kind of natural place to go.
I see, yeah. So, you know, most people these days think about Anonymous as this kind of, you know, nebulous collective of these shadowy populist activists. But, you know, as you allude, the concept has its roots in this kind of online prank culture and LULZ and stuff. For people who don't know, what's LULZ?
LULZ is a bastardization and pluralization of the more commonly known acronym, Laugh Out Loud. Right. And it's a kind of term that's used when people kind of troll or prank an individual or an organization, and it's kind of a deviant, dark form of humor. So you may do something funny, and again, it can be quite playful, or it can be mischievous, or it could be really horrifying. And the trolls will say, "Well, I did it for the LULZ. I did it for the laughs."
Yeah, so it actually, the coalescence of Anonymous in the form that we know it today seems to come from a lot of the same sources as many common elements of internet culture, like, you know, lolcats or memes. Where did this all start?
So the collective name Anonymous started on the image board 4chan, which is a very iconic and controversial and interesting image board that was started in 2003. And at some point, it's not really known exactly when, people started to use the name Anonymous to engage in some pretty fearsome trolling campaigns, pranking campaigns that were directed at individuals or organizations. And so it was a name that different people located on the internet would take, again, to organize these forms of kind of fearsome internet pranking. And it came with a certain sort of iconography, usually in the form of a headless man wearing a suit. So then in 2008, something very interesting happened. Again, the name Anonymous was used to troll the Church of Scientology after the church tried to censor a video of Tom Cruise. And it was a video that was a kind of internal church video. And then Anonymous took a U-turn away from trolling and into activism.
So what do you think catalyzed the shift that this group saw that came as a surprise to anyone who was watching internet culture, this shift toward activist causes like exposing the abuses of Scientology or the abuses of privacy by telecoms companies? Why did they suddenly change and focus on causes?
Yeah, you know, it was so interesting when it was happening, because just recently someone who was part of the trolling era of Anonymous tweeted at me and said, "You know, Biela, Anonymous was never supposed to become political. It was never supposed to be activism. We were hellraisers, you know. How did this happen?" And I still think Anonymous is a great example of a historical aberration, just because you went from these hellraisers into people who cared about social justice and corruption. And the transition is one that, on the one hand, is difficult to explain, and on the other hand, actually makes total sense. And what I mean is that some of the prior trolling campaigns before Anonymous kind of entered into the seas of activism had a proto-political quality to them. So, for example, they targeted Hal Turner, who is a radio personality in the United States, and they kind of pranked him. But in the process, they discovered he was an FBI informant, right?
Wow.
And then a lot of people were excited that they kind of exposed this wrongdoing. And so they started to kind of get a sense of their political power. But the transition was really cemented when they targeted the Church of Scientology, which again was first this fearsome trolling campaign. And Anonymous then published a video, which was done for the LULZ, for the humor, and it was a joke. And in the video, they declared war against the Church of Scientology. But it was such a compelling video, the tricksters got trapped by their own rhetoric in a lot of ways, and
yeah,
they started
I remember,
to debate.
Actually.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal video.
Yeah.
It's so well done. And they started to debate, well, you know, they're kind of creepy, these Scientologists. Maybe we should earnestly protest them. And in fact, that's what they did. They organized a day of protests on February 10th, 2008, and 7,000 people, 7,000 nerds and geeks from the internet showed up.
Yeah, I remember that. It was the first time I'd seen them take it offline and come offline, and it was so surprising to see that, you know, they could materialize some of those messages and actions in the real world.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people who came out that first day, they really just wanted to meet other people from this image board 4chan, which is truly anonymous. But there's something about experiencing, you know, protests on the street, right? And then they got a lot of media validation. They were splattered all over the news. And then this was really the moment that activist sensibility was born.
So you said many times in the book that for, you know, while you were doing this research, for your own legal safety and for that of anonymous participants, you avoided being directly present for private channel conversations related to the operations planning. But nonetheless, do you have any insights into how these days, how Anonymous decides on its targets and assembles ops in general? Any common tactics that you're aware of?
So what's interesting is that Anonymous has gotten involved in such different types of political causes, from, you know, exposing rape cases in North America to getting involved in these big revolutions in the Middle East. And the reason and way that they get involved in each case is so different, it's difficult to kind of come up with a universal explanation. But it is often the case that there's either personal interest from someone involved or someone reaches out to Anonymous. So, for example, in the case of Operation Ferguson, which concerns the shooting of a young African-American man in the United States, someone on Twitter kind of said, you know, who's going to help out? Who's going to help out here? And someone anonymous got wind of it, right?
Right.
That said, you know, one of the ways to understand why they're able to kind of react very quickly is because there's this kind of idea that Anonymous is just an amorphous blob that kind of just comes into being randomly and haphazardly, when in fact there's often small teams of people who work together, who are friends, and it's because they're these small teams that they can quickly rear into action. The teams are dynamic, they're flexible, they get reconstituted, but nevertheless, that's really, really one important point of stability that helps explain why they can jump into action so quickly when they decide to get involved in an operation.
That is an element that I think not a lot of people understand well, is that Anonymous is an idea and not like a club. You know, like anyone can be Anonymous, you know, to some extent. But then there are, as you say, also consistent groups sort of operating within that band, underneath that banner. On one hand, there's an implicit ethos that ideas take precedence over the individual. But is there also an element of fame seeking to the performance of these kind of raids and ops or not?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the great contradictions or ironies about Anonymous, is that on the one hand, it really is taboo to seek fame and recognition for the individual. And one may say, well, of course they need to conceal themselves. They're breaking the law. But, you know, many people Anonymous are not breaking the law, and they could easily say, hey, look, I made this video. I'm an Anonymous. And in fact, some people have done this, and they have been absolutely skewered and chastised and marginalized. I mean, it really is not okay to do this. And even an outsider like myself sometimes gets called to task for gaining kind of recognition and some measure of fame for the work I do, right? But on the other hand, Anonymous is this kind of celebrity phenomena. It's very Hollywood-esque.
Yeah, very many people nowadays, Robin Hood stories.
Exactly. And many people in Anonymous really do seek media attention for the collective, both because they know that it helps the cause, and, you know, there's a measure of pride when that happens. And one of the interesting things that I detail in the book is the tensions that arose when particular Twitter accounts or, you know, people who were behind pseudonyms like Sabu, the famous hacker, became quite famous, right? Or there were breakaway hacker groups like Antisec or Lulsec who gained a lot of fame. And people were quite critical of that. You know, people weren't operating under the banner of a real name, but nevertheless it was kind of violating this commitment that you should simply do it for the name Anonymous. But that's very hard to actually bring into being or follow at all times.
Absolutely. And through the course of your research, you met one-on-one with a number of individuals and sort of got to know them and how these complicated and maze-like paradoxes are often expressed through the individual. Can you talk about some of the folks that you met and how this paradox was expressed?
Yeah, so it was really kind of fascinating because early on in my research, I had to rely on my imagination to imagine who was behind the mask, right? And you know, I kind of defaulted to this idea that everyone was white, middle-class American and between the ages of 15 and like 22, right?
Right.
That was kind of what I was working with. And then between people being arrested and unmasked and then also just people coming, reaching out to me in various ways, I started to meet various kind of participants in Anonymous. And well, I can't say there's radical diversity insofar as, you know, when it comes to the hackers especially, there's no woman. It was far more diverse than expected. And I like the example of LulzSec, which is a kind of breakaway hacker group, and everyone involved was involved in Anonymous. Among its ranks were a Puerto Rican living in the housing projects in New York City, Sabu. There was an ex-military who had served time in Iraq, Ryan, also known as Kayla. There were two Irish chemistry students, one of whom had, you know, kind of a really deep background with politics. And then there was also a 16-year-old Iraqi immigrant in London, Mustafa Al-Bassam. And so you can see right there that there's a lot more diversity than one would expect. And I think that there's something about the pseudo-anonymity of the environment that allows people who might normally not connect to come together around a cause. And it really doesn't matter what your offline politics are or your background. It doesn't really enter into the equation. So yeah, it was very, very surprising that there was far more diversity than one would expect.
So you describe some times in your work, particularly early on in the book, that you were afraid for your own safety or that you felt paranoid. But it wasn't necessarily Anonymous that you were most often afraid of, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was definitely the state and you know, state surveillance and implanted informants in Anonymous.
Right. So you describe a meeting that you attended and then you were worried that your hotel room might have been bugged. And has the work that you've done perhaps enhanced your mistrust of the state?
It has. It definitely has. You know, it was so funny because when I first jumped into this world, I was like, wow, this is a playful, mischievous world of activism. And then as soon as, you know, major hacks started coming and they were directed at corporations and the government, I knew the game had changed dramatically. You know, the government has never been too kind to hackers. And here we had, you know, a kind of explosive nonstop activity. And so I knew that there would be a lot of surveillance and informants. And it initially, you know, wasn't that palpable. But at a certain point in Anonymous, everyone started to talk about this possibility. And there was always rumors and there was a kind of, you know, paranoia that was constantly hanging over everything. And it just was a pervasive unease that would never go away. And it started kind of in the summer of 2001 and really peaked when it was revealed in March of 2012 that Sabu, who had been this very charismatic hacker, was in fact working for the FBI.
And do you think the state response to what started as just sort of playful, coordinated online raids sort of galvanized that mistrust and created some cohesion for the movement, perhaps?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a way in which, you know, Anonymous was very well aware that they were looked upon very disfavorably by the state, right? And that they knew there were informants implanted inside. But I think it does take the revelation of, you know, the actual identity of an informant to really hit home at some level.
Yeah.
And that's again, one of the ironies. Everyone knows this is going on, but it's only when the news hits the newspaper where the reality sinks into the bones and practices actually shift dramatically. The security kind of got much better after the fact that it was revealed that Sabu was an informant.
So, of course, this concept of the faceless subversive group that spontaneously can rise up to assist revolution or to unveil abuse, of course, that's, you know, romantic to a lot of onlookers. And so despite this history of you know, the earlier sort of more chaotic trolling days that were, you know, destructive to people, despite all of that, you assert that Anonymous has largely been a force for good in the world.
I do. And it's, you know, I don't want to whitewash either their history and also certain tactics and moments in their political operations I've personally disagreed with. I really don't like it when people's privacy is violated. And this has definitely happened in the course of numerous operations from time to time. But I do think that generally it has been a force for good. And in fact, what I find really amazing is that actually trolling is quite fearsome and it's quite cynical. You know, everything about it is actually not about kind of social justice or making the world a better place. It's almost the opposite. And the fact that those who were involved in that sort of activity and the fact that the name had that history and then could take a radical U-turn into a different territory, an activist territory, I think is a very hopeful and important story. I think it does show that cynicism and apathy are very common. I think that they're very hard to stamp out, but under the right conditions, people do want to kind of leave behind cynicism and apathy and kind of channel their energies towards doing social good. And Anonymous is, again, a perfect example of that. I've also met a lot of the individual participants, and many of them really absolutely earnestly care about the causes, the political causes that they've supported, and have either worked prior to Anonymous in activism, or Anonymous was their kind of gateway drug, I like to say, into activism. And it's important that there's grassroots channels for people who may not, you know, have access to political institutions. It's really important for them to have these channels by which they can kind of express the causes they believe in.
So what do you think is next for Anonymous?
So, you know, first, I'm surprised that Anonymous kind of lasted for so long. You know, they came into being as an activist force in 2008, and you know, we recently saw a big operation in 2014 with Ferguson, but it is certainly the case that most of 2014, with the exception of really strong operations in Latin America and a few other parts of the world, it's been a little bit idle. They haven't been as active. And in some ways, I always wonder, is this the kind of end to a really remarkable theatrical political run? Or are they just kind of running idle for a period and then there'll be a kind of reinvention, an unexpected reinvention in the future? They are perfectly positioned for reinvention insofar as anyone can take the name and then different groups get involved, and it means Anonymous is going to look very different. And the fact that there is no single kind of political ideology or even set of characters identified with Anonymous makes it perfect for reinvention, right? So something like WikiLeaks is identified with Julian Assange, right? So it's him or it's not. And because Anonymous has that freedom to kind of go anywhere, I do think that in the future we'll see a kind of different form or format of Anonymous come into being.
Thank you very much. Dr. Gabriella Coleman, author of Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy. It's available now?
It is. It is available now. It was released the day before Guy Fawkes Day, actually.
Good
so
timing.
Everyone can have the book for the revolution.
Great timing. Thank you so much for joining us, Biela.
You're welcome.
Thanks again to Dr. Gabriella Coleman. Her book, Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, is published by Verso Books and available now. Thank you so much for joining us for Tech Weekly. I'm Lee Alexander. My producer is Jason Phipps, and you can find us at guardian.com/technology.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.